This Week in Retronauts, we're five talking. Everyone, welcome to Retronauts episode. Oh, I did it again. I forgot to look at the episode number, but I can be forgiven because this episode was not supposed to exist. This was never supposed to happen. But no, here we are with episode 695, the third part of our years in review, the annual tradition, which is supposed to happen in January. And here we are mid-May. I think this episode goes out in June. We really kind of biffed it. But every time we do one of these, the scope creep just makes them go longer and longer. And, 10 years from now, the entire year will just be spent talking about the games of 10, 20, 30, and 40 years prior. Such is our lives. Anyway, this time we are talking 30 years ago, 1995. It was 30 years ago, and we are disappearing into mummy dust. I am the host mummy for this episode. I am your mummy. I am Jeremy Parrish. And with me here in the sarcophagus of retro gaming, we have the usual host of not idiots, fun loving friends.
Surf! Turf!
Okay, one idiot. Who was that idiot?
That I am the idiot mummy that lives under your house in Aqua Teens. I am Jared Petty.
Oh, see, I never saw that, so I didn't get the reference. I thought you were just screaming for no reason.
No, I was being a mummy.
There was a reason for your screaming. Okay, well, welcome, Jared Petty. I apologize for calling you an idiot. It was actually...
I'm kind of an idiot, Jeremy. It's okay.
Fair enough. I'll concede the point. Let's see, who else is here in the RDU triangle where we are currently under a biblical level of rain?
That would be me, Benj Edwards.
Hello, Benj Edwards.
Just to warn you, this is not going to be a funny episode. All the joy is drained from my life. And so don't expect any witty witticisms from me.
Why is the joy drained from your life?
Because I drank a Coke yesterday and I have low blood sugar today.
That'll do it.
Everything's fine, really. I mean, I've got a great family and pretty good job. But
you drank a Coke. Okay.
I guess that was witty. Shit. That was kind of witty. Sorry. I just wanted to prepare you to be let down.
I feel so much better about surf turf now.
Well, I don't know what surf turf means anyway.
It's, steak and lobster.
I know that much.
I've
been to the Angus Barn, Jeremy.
Have you? Wow, Mr. Yeah. Moneybags over here.
Yeah, Mr. and Mrs. Moneybags.
Nice. And finally, the sane person in the room. Not actually in the room.
Far away. It's your local Ramses II. It's Kevin Bunch.
Wow. I think I shot you one time in Life Force.
That's fine. I showed up again in Eternal Champions and had a great time.
Excellent. Okay.
What you did to Moses was not okay.
Listen,
I threw baby Moses in the river once, so I can't say anything.
You can't part the Red Sea and just expect to get away with it, right? Am I right?
That's what a ginger calls combing their hair. Hey, anyway, so let's move along to talk about the video games and events of 1995. We've regaled you with exciting tales of 1975 and 85. There might have been a 65 in there. I can't remember. It was a strange vintage. But we are now on to 1995. And sadly, the one person who really wanted to talk about 1995 is not able to join us for this episode, Chris Sims. He has scheduling conflicts, which is very tragic because he sat in on two episodes in which he could not really participate that much, waiting, just biding his time, and now his time is here, and he had to bid us farewell. Very, very sad and ironic, but that is life. That's all Alanis Morissette's fault. Was that a 1995 song? It might have been.
That sounds right.
Six, maybe. Alanis
Morissette. That sounds about right. Ironic. So if we do the ironic, oh, 1995. Yes, Jagged Little Pill. Wow. See, there we go. So
nice.
This episode was born to be ironic. In a way, Chris not making it. It's like a new job when they make a podcast. Okay, I don't know.
Whoa. I did not expect you to sing today.
Don't I sound just like Alanis?
I'm just impressed Alanis knew what a podcast was in 1995.
She was ahead of the curve. She was, ironically, way ahead of things.
Traffic jam when you're already late. A no smoking sign on your cigarette break. It's like 10,000 spoons when all you need is a knife. It's meeting the man of my dreams and then meeting his beautiful wife.
So anyway, in addition to a song on the radio that pedants could get so angry about, we had lots of things happening in the video game world. And none were bigger and more momentous then the launch of the Virtual Boy. Benj, take it away. Tell us about the launch, the biggest thing to hit video games in 1995.
It's like 10,000 spoons when all you need is a knife. That's what the Virtual Boy was like.
It was like ironic. It was like 10,000 knives in your eyeball.
10,000 knives, yeah. Well, they tell me I'm supposed to be an expert about the Virtual Boy.
At the very least, you faked it convincingly in a book. So
I faked it long enough to convince MIT Press to let me co-write a book called, I already forgot what it's called, Seeing Red. had to check my notes there.
Wasn't that about a panda?
Yeah, a red panda. Pixar. Anyway, let's see. Okay.
I like how easy it is to get you thrown off yeah. off the topic. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah. Let's yeah. Squirrel.
Virtual Boy is the novelization of that film.
Yeah.
Is that how it works?
Virtual Boy launched in 1995. So, yeah, that's the right year. July 21st, 1995 in Japan. August 14th, 1995 in the United States. I don't know what to say that I haven't already said. I mean, it's the weirdest, craziest game console.
Well, then why'd you put your name next to the item?
I don't know. I told you I'm all off. My feng shui is out of alignment, and my architecture is in remission. The third moons in the sun and stuff.
You hit
like
that Coca-Cola,
you know,
Jeremy.
Yeah, I hit that hard stuff.
Emphasis on the Coke.
I'll just tell you that the Virtual Boy is a stereoscopic, you know, semi-portable game console that has red-only graphics, and it sold 770,000 units worldwide, 140,000 in Japan, 630,000 in the U.S. It's probably a statistical error because the U.S. is much larger than Japan. So I don't know if it was like proportionally that much more popular or just, you know, there's so much more people. But it was discontinued in only about 5 or 6 months later in Japan in December of 95. But it held out in America for about a year. Till August of 96, and it had a lot of price cuts.
I mean, it kind of held out in the U.S. for a year, but the last game came out in February, so
yeah, March.
They were just kind of kicking it down the road, like, oh, there's going to be more games, just you wait, kids. Look out, here comes Dragon Hopper, or whatever it's called. Yeah, yeah, just hang on. Don't give up. Please buy the stock that is in the stores and no one wants.
You kind of get the impression that inside Nintendo, when they first showed this thing off, people clapped and like, yeah, 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 and then walked out of there and kind of going, oh, no. Oh, no. Oh, no. And they had to know. Like, it's a neat thing, but I think they had to know it wasn't going to sell well.
Yeah. I mean, boy, we wrote a book about this, I guess. there's like, you know, it was a novelty project from Gunpei Yokoi, who saw this technology from Reflection Technologies, a Massachusetts-based company. And he thought it was cool, and it was an expression of his withered technology ethos, which is like using some kind of cheap, readily available technology to make some new thing, like the Game Boy with a dot matrix LCD and like the Game & Watch that had, you know, watch type technology and stuff. And so it was, I think they knew it wasn't ever really going to be successful. It was sort of like a placeholder for while the N64 was still cooking. So they needed to get a product out the door, and they just needed to get it done.
I don't think it was designed as a novelty product. I really think that the idea, you know, as it originally existed, was that this would be the next generation portable Nintendo system. It would be a new, amazing experience. But then as the realities of it set in and they had to keep making compromises, it just became less and less compelling. You know, I think it's the kind of like the fake maxim about the frog that doesn't, you know, notice that the water's boiling until it's dead. Mm-hmm. It was just one of those things where, like, here over here is the platonic ideal of Virtual Boy, which would have been incredible. It would have been so good. And then here's the actual release version, which was no longer really portable because it weighed too much, because, you know, there were FCC regulations that required, not necessarily required, but they were concerned about radiation emission being that close to a person's face since you stick your face in the machine. And so all of a sudden it has this metal framework inside of it that makes it too heavy to carry around conveniently. It can't be face mounted. You know, they could only get the red LEDs because everything else was too expensive. A year later, multicolored LEDs would have been, you know, totally affordable, but we were just on the cusp of consumer level colored LCDs capable of creating a full range of, you know, full gamut of RGB color. So it was just bad timing and technology that sounded good in theory, but in practice just didn't work out. And
yeah, it's such a neat idea, but it'd be almost impossible to sell. Looking at it from a marketing perspective, without a screen, it's very difficult to show anyone what's going on. And if you just watch someone having fun with it, they inherently look like an idiot because of the shape of the device. Yeah. So it's a really
Palmer
hard
lucky beta testing.
Yeah, it's a hard thing to sell. How do you convince someone? As a kid, I was fascinated by the 3D, and I actually really liked the Virtual Boy as a child. But I got the headache after half an hour and was like, okay, I don't know how much I really want to play with this. And you combine the fact that it's hard to show off, with the fact that you look dumb holding it, with the fact that it was probably a little too pricey, with all the compromises you just pointed out, a good idea didn't pan out. And to their credit, I think it was very wise of Nintendo to kill it when they did. But I do hate that things like, you know, Mario Clash, for example, are still locked away behind that wall. Yeah. There's some neat games on there.
Yeah, I think compromises is a good way to describe what happened here, because this was like a period where the idea of VR gaming was having a time. It was a moment. And this is really the only thing from that push that I feel like really got to market. And even then, it's not really virtual reality. But, like, I know Sega was working on a VR helmet for the Genesis. Hasbro was working with the Sardoff Labs to develop a VR system that was going to run all sorts of funky Maxis games and whatnot. And all of those died because, you know, that they were too heavy, or they ran really poorly.
Tetsuya Mizuguchi.
They were too expensive.
Mizuguchi, you know, of Rez fame, actually told me that he was working on a 3D visualization project for the Game Gear, which is wild to think about. But then I remembered, oh yeah, the Sega Master System did have the 3D glasses. So
yeah.
You know, that was a thing. It was part of video games ever since Sega gave us Sub-Rock 3D with the periscope that you look through to create the dual screen, you know, alternate active shutter system.
Yeah, so you guys just made me look bad, but the best thing, you know, if you want to hear us, we talked really great about the Virtual Boy on the, I think we did a podcast, Jeremy, with me and Jose about the book. That was, if you're interested in the Virtual Boy, I highly recommend listening to that. So it's like the whole console was a bit of an enigma, and it was like a series of compromises and other things. It's weird and wild.
But it totally had a bunch of really cool games on it too. I mean, it had some, you know, it had Waterworld as well, but it had some really neat games.
I think the only game that came out for Virtual Boy in any territory that is not locked to Virtual Boy is Panic Bomber, the Bomberman puzzle game, which also came out on a few other systems. Mm-hmm. Everything else, you can't play it unless you play it on Virtual Boy. Like the Wario Land game, the original Mario Tennis is still on Virtual Boy, and that's where it got started, and that's where it lives. There was that sort of Star Fox quarter shooter, Red Alarm.
There was that's a good game.
There was a top-down Star Force, Star Soldier type game called Vertical Force. Mm-hmm. The first Shin Megami Tensei game that ever came to America was a like a dungeon shooter, kind of a like imagine you're Jack Frost playing the Binding of Isaac, and that's kind of what it was like without the randomization.
Jack
Some
Brothers,
really
right?
weird thing. Yes, Jack yeah. Brothers. There was an amazing, interesting Lovecraft themed first person corridor shooter called Innsmouth no Yakata, which like it's actually really cool and good, and you can play through it in about 15 minutes, but it has this branching corridor system based on your performance. So you have to like play perfectly to get the good ending, because it kind of does that Darius puzzle bobble, like branching stage thing, but you don't have any control over which stage you end up in. It's just based on how well you play. So there's some really cool stuff on Virtual Boy. There's also some really dreadful stuff. Ask me how I know, but it's all out there. And it's really interesting because the system only had 22 games in total in all regions, but attempting to acquire a complete set is nigh impossible because the last few games that came out in Japan were released, just kind of pushed out the door in vanishingly small numbers. I've heard rumors that they were like two-digit quantities of those.
Oh my gosh, really? That
I don't know if that's true, but... Like, I feel like there's got to be, like, an MOQ on how many Virtual Boy games you had to make. But maybe not. I don't know. At that point, Nintendo, I think, didn't care. I mean, to the point that Virtual Lab, the box, misspells Nintendo three different ways. So, I mean,
That's also the worst game.
Yeah.
Virtual Lab, yeah.
It is. Although there was a great piece on... The Bad Games Hall of Fame, an interview with the programmer of that game like 2 years ago, that offered some interesting insights. It doesn't like make the game any better, but it does at least make you understand, oh, the reason this game is bad is because the person who was responsible for it had to program it in a weekend without knowing the hardware in any way whatsoever. So yes, that explains why the game was complete shit.
Wow, I think I need to read this book.
You do.
Because that's a story I want to hear.
Oh, it's not a book. It's a website, Bad Games Hall of Fame. I want to say that's the website that it's on. The webmaster let me quote little bits of that in the second printing of my Virtual Boy book. Yes, I have one too.
Yeah, we sold about, I think, 500... 60 copies of my book, so that's a new record
for my book,
for any book that I've co-authored.
I feel like that's pretty good for Virtual Boy.
Yeah,
that probably outsells some of the games.
That's like a one-to-one attach rate.
That's like the best for a book. It's like, I think the Bible only sold 800, so like I think that's pretty good.
I supposedly made over $500. I haven't seen it yet, but like that's a pretty good return on my original $30 investment for the buying a Virtual Boy at Toys R Us, right?
Yeah.
Thank you.
All right, well, congrats on the numbers. And thanks. Now we should talk about the other things that came out that year. Sega Saturn launched. I think we would call that a premature launch. It was 5 years ago this week, actually, from the time of our recording. But it sort of dropped precipitously at $399. We should talk about $299, though, because that might be the single most remarkable instance of just a, like, is it an own goal? It's just canny opportunism, I would guess.
It's so, either this or that time Kenji Eno did the thing with the logo, but I think it's this.
The thing with the logo.
Oh yeah, where he was going to announce that he was making games exclusively for PlayStation at the PlayStation conference, and the PlayStation logo behind him morphed into a Saturn logo at the conference. He said, "I'm producing exclusively for Saturn," and walked out.
Oh, okay.
A bunch of Sony execs standing there furious.
I did not know about that, but that does sound like a Kenji Eno thing, sort of thing to do.
Yeah, so, Milky told that story.
Ah, okay, of course. I mean, that would have been my guess, yeah. So all of this ties into the first ever Electronic Entertainment Exposition, RIP, that took place in 1995. Prior to this, video game stuff was just kind of crowded into a little tent next to the porn at Consumer Entertainment Show in Vegas and Chicago each year. And finally, video games said, we should have our own show with hookers and blackjack. In fact, forget the hookers. And so they had the E3. And let's see, the first one I think was in Atlanta, and then it eventually moved over to LA.
From what I've heard of the old E3s, they did not, in fact, forget the sex workers.
Oh, okay.
But that's a whole other can of worms.
Well, there you go. I mean, certainly when you went to the LA Convention Center and left the building, the premises, there were people handing out cards to Spearmint Rhino or whatever that was called, the strip club. Never actually went there myself, but every year there were people out there, you know, ladies handing out the cards. Come see us. Mm-hmm. We won't be wearing clothes if you do. So I guess that's all part and parcel of nerds. But anyway, E3, Sega came out and dropped a megaton saying, yes, our new system, the Saturn, is coming this year, but it's not coming this fall like we previously announced. You can go to 3 different retailers right now and buy the system. And people said, oh, okay. There was no like build up or marketing hype leading up to it. It was just kind of there. And then all the retailers that were not the chosen retailers said, Sega, what? Like, why did we get locked out of this? So it was just a bad choice all around. $400 and it kind of just whiffed. Go ahead.
I have a small short story about the Saturn launch. That's just sort of illustrative of that. It's, I was at Toys R Us one day, maybe a weekend in 1995, and I was walking down the aisle and suddenly the Saturn was there and for sale. And I had never confused the heck out of me because I didn't know it was coming. Like I had video game magazines and I guess I knew it was coming in the future, but like suddenly it was there as a big, and like just shocked me. So yeah, that's how weird it was, the launch. And so it caught consumers off guard too, because we didn't know that it was coming. You know, nobody to spend $400 on a console, you kind of have to plan for it in 1995, because that's a lot of money.
Absolutely. The stealth launch was a disaster for so many reasons. Consumers weren't ready for it. Even their biggest fans weren't ready for it since they announced it at E3, which at that time was not covered the way that shows are now. There wasn't nearly as much, you know, games press coverage of it. And so it took a while for the word to get out. And beyond that, though, they made it exclusive to, I think, 3 retailers.
Yep.
And cut everybody else out, including, I kid you not, Walmart in a pre-internet world. Pre-internet, there's no Amazon. You can't buy the Saturn at Walmart. And that angered Walmart, and that they didn't want to carry stuff for Sega. And it just turned into a nightmare that lasted them actually for years. Took forever to clear. They were still dealing with that during the Dreamcast, like 4 years later.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Amazon only sold books at that time, I guess.
Yes.
Technically, books. It was around in 95, I guess.
It was around. I bought books from them around that time. But
yeah. I remember back when Amazon sold books as opposed to having no idea what books are.
Yeah. Books are strange.
Anyway, so all of this is sort of preface to Sony's press conference the following day, where the company's president got out onto stage and simply said $299 and then left. And that was it, saying, you know, this system is going to be $100 cheaper than the Saturn. And also the subtext, you know, also being we didn't screw over our retail partners, which was really what E3 was for at that point. It was for retailers and buyers. So just kind of coming in saying, hello, we're doing this. And why would you team up with Sega when you could team up with us instead? And the system arrived like 3 months later.
Yep.
And did gangbusters. And Sega or Sony is still a major force in video games. And Sega, they've been doing really well for themselves lately. I just read yesterday that their year-over-year profits were way, way up because they sat down and said, what if we just made really good games? And it's paid off for them.
Yeah, Shenmue gave us Saturn gave us Shenmue, and Shenmue gave us Yakuza, and so Sega's cool now. That's my take.
Except Saturn didn't really give us Shenmue because they didn't get that version out.
No,
so they didn't. Saturn wasn't even good for that. Saturn's actually a really good and interesting system, just not in America. Right. If you go all in on the Japanese stuff, the library there is amazing. It's expansive and vast and so varied. Here in America, not so much.
The Saturn is the ideal importer's paradise that everyone dreams of. I think when they think about importing games, like the Saturn collection actually feels like that. Yep. I've been collecting Saturn games for years, and I'll still come across things I've never heard of that are awesome. Mm-hmm. It's great.
You do have to watch out for the occasional bare booby, but generally those are not as prevalent as they would have been on like the, you know, latter day PC Engine or PCFX or something. So just advance with caution. Yes, it's a minefield of
milk.
Yes. Okay. Anyway, well done, Sony. I have to stop now.
You killed Jeremy.
You broke him. Good job.
You killed Jeremy.
Good.
Anyway.
I told you it'd be a bad day.
That was actually the funniest thing you've said.
Thank you.
So those are kind of the big events. I'm going to do this. I'm going to go down an alphabetical list of arcade games, and then we're going to circle back and talk about the things that are of interest to us individually, and we'll see if we can make it through here. So here we go, in no particular order, it's alphabetical. 19XX, The War Against Destiny, which actually, I don't know if the episode is out yet, but there's a Capcom Shooters episode that I recorded at Midwest Gaming Classic with Kevin Bunch here, talking about 19XX, The War Against Destiny. Also, on a similar front, we have Aero Fighters 3.
Great
the
game.
The great game Ark Invader, or no, Ak Invader? Is it Ak Invader? I thought it was Ark Invader.
Ak Invader.
Oh my god, I messed up. Area 51, where you kill aliens that are being held captive, I think. It sounds horrible, but that was America in the 90s. Baku Baku Animal. Battle Balls. is that like, I can't remember the name of the game, like Magnetica or something like that? Where there's like a spiral of orbs and you have to like move them around.
Oh, I don't know. Colors? Yeah, I remember that game. Yeah, I'm not sure.
Okay. Bubble Memories, the game where you remember Bub and Bob. Cyber Troopers Virtual On, the latest in the Virtua series from Sega. Except it's not a Virtua game, it's Virtual. So I guess it's not tied to that. It's kind of weird. DDR Mega Mix, the next generation version of the Snack Mix, Chex Mix. Is that right? Yes. Donpachi, was this the origin of the bullet shooter, the bullet hell?
It's one of the first major ones. We'll get to that.
Double Dragon Neo Geo. That's not actually its title. It's just Double Dragon, but it was on Neo Geo, which differentiated it from the Double Dragons that are fun and good. Extreme Downhill, which is kind of what the Neo Geo Double Dragon series represented. Fatal Fury... Fatal Fury 3, now featuring three times as much Mai Shiranui. Fighting Vipers, featuring no Mai Shiranui. It's a different fighting series. Galaxy Fight. I don't even know what Mai has to do with Galaxy Fight, but that was a tie-in to Trip World, wasn't it?
I do not know. I have never played Galaxy Fight.
Oh, I think that was wasn't that the Sunsoft fighting game?
It is. Yeah. I don't know how it relates to Trip World, but
Jacopo is like a hidden character or something. The cute little fuzzy guy from Trip World. It's a really weird choice. Gal's Panic 3. Speaking of boobies, that's boobies plus quicks or kicks if you're like that. Game Tengoku. Golden Tee, finally, ooh, after more than a decade, someone figured out how to do golf games a different way than Nintendo did.
One of the most popular arcade games ever.
Mm-hmm. Kabuki Clash, you can tell it's serious business because it starts with a K. It must be a fighting game like Mortal Kombat. The King of Fighters 95, Kevin, I'm surprised you didn't stick your name next to this one.
Yeah, I can only stick my name next to so many games. So
I guess you have talked about a lot of SNK fighters recently, haven't you?
I have.
You and Diamond, yeah. Yeah, okay, so that's fair. Kyokyoku Tiger 2, which is sort of a sequel-ish to Tiger Heli for NES, but way fancier. Manx TT, some sort of racing game, I don't know. Marvel Superheroes, if Chris Sims were here, he would tell us all about it, but he's not. So instead, I'll tell you about Mega Man The Power Battle, which is kind of a Mega Man fighting game, but actually just more like boss, like just a boss gauntlet of Mega Man games. And you pick up powers from the guy you defeat. And it's an interesting idea. I don't know if I like it, but it's an interesting idea. Night Warriors, which this is the predecessor to Darkstalkers, right?
I think this one is the first Darkstalkers. I think.
Okay, so Darkstalkers is also... I thought it was Night Warriors, Darkstalkers, and then Darkstalkers 3. Or is it Darkstalkers, then Night Warriors, then Darkstalkers 3? I know that Darkstalkers
right.
3. Yeah.
I think you're right. This is the second one. I keep forgetting that had a different name in the US.
And they're still using that Morrigan sprite to this day. 30 years later. Pang 3. Power Instincts Legends. Psychic Force. Polestar. Puzzle Bobble 2X, the Quiz King of Fighters, which I've actually played a little bit of despite the language barrier, and it is a King of Fighters quiz game. It's not really about King of Fighters trivia. It's just like, you know, dressing around quiz game stuff.
No kidding, really?
Yeah. Yep. Rave Racer, which is like Ridge Racer, but ravier. Real Bout Fatal Fury. So how can we have, okay, is Real Bout Fatal Fury the same as Fatal Fury 3?
No, they're two different games that came all out right on either end of the same year.
This would
year
explain why you didn't sign up for King of Fighters. So we'll get back to that. Rise of the Robots, Sando R, the famous game about sandwiches, Sega Rally Championship, everyone's favorite racing game that has a cool theme song that says, yeah, Shaq Attack, Soul Edge, the game that gave us Soul Calibur, Street Fighter Alpha and Street Fighter the Movie, Strikers 1945, no relation to 1943, but kind of the same game, Tekken 2, Twinbee Yahoo, the search engine shooter, Ultimate Mortal Kombat 3, Virtua Cop 2, Virtua Fighter 2, Voltage Fighter Gaukaiser. I've never seen the game, but I am familiar with the anime from the trailers that would play before, I think it was AD Vision videotapes. And
it's very true to those trailers.
Okay. All right. So Fighters After Dark kind of thing. And finally, World Heroes Perfect. Is it really, though?
Yeah, I mean, look, that is a lot of fighting games. That's a 1995 arcade right there. Wow.
That is.
Sort of the end of that boom period. Yeah.
So let's circle back around, and there were a few items here that some of you wanted to talk about in greater depth. So let's start with the one that's not a fighting game, Akinvader. Kevin, what the hell?
Akan Vader came out in the U.S. as Space Invaders 1995, the Attack of the Lunar Loonies. This is basically what if Parodius was made as a Space Invaders game. So, you know, it's very goofy, very silly. There's a lot of references to other Taito projects, like the first boss. You don't fight him yourself, but in the background, there's the general from their fighting game, Kaiser Knuckle, who's like the impossible final boss.
Do you at some point fight Rastan?
Oh, gosh, I don't know, because I've never made it super far in this game, but I wouldn't be shocked if there's a Rastan, like, reference in there.
If you do fight
there's
him.
There's a Darius reference.
If you do fight Rastan, his magic sword burns out just before he gets to you, so it's okay.
And I think my favorite part is that you have, like, a selection of characters, like, in Parodius, too, right? And one of them is the girl from Kiki Kai Kai. So you can play as Pocky from Pocky and Rocky.
That's so cool.
Yeah, it's a very silly game. It's a very, like, interesting take on Space Invaders, and I'm pretty sure it was the last, major arcade Space Invaders game.
Probably.
Yeah. It's very much worth checking out. I don't think it's really available that readily right now, but it's on some of the old PS2 collections. Yeah. If it's on the third volume of the Ygritte 2 mini
Still need to get that card. Okay.
But yeah,
off to EV I go. Yeah, so I feel like this was not the game to save Space Invaders' fortunes, but it's an admirable attempt anyway. The parody game thing kind of peaked like 5 years before this came out, so it feels a little behind the times. But it is charming and goofy and fun. And I do have to keep reminding myself that a Taito PS2 collection from 20 years ago is not a current release.
Yeah, it's wrong to think about. But, you know, this was there's still some parody game things, just, you know, from all the other companies that weren't Konami and whatnot. Because I think Game Ten Goku is also kind of a sort of a parody thing, too, for Data East, I think it is.
I'm pretty excited.
Or no, Jalico.
Because I just bought all four Taito Memories discs from Japan. Like, they have twice as many as we did there for PS2 and a Japanese PS2. So I'll bet you Akan Vader's on there. I've never played it. I'm pretty excited.
I'm pretty sure it is.
All right. I get to play it. Yay! Just brought that home.
And I just added Ygritte 2 Mini Arcade Memories Volume 3 to my eBay cart.
Excellent.
Thanks for nothing, Kevin.
You're welcome.
Right. So Jared is highlighting Chris Sims.
Oh, no, that's
thing,
sorry. That was
that
just
you're not going to talk about.
Yeah, I was just moving my cursor around foolishly.
But you could talk about Cyber Troopers Virtual On, the game from Sega, not Capcom.
I will talk about Cyber Troopers Virtual On. It's the very first VO game. And I was not there in Japan in 1995 to enjoy this when it was new. Oh, no. I came much later, a decade later, to sad, dying-esque Japanese arcades. Not as sad and dying as they are now after COVID, but they were still kind of sad and starting to die. But one thing you could still find when I lived in Japan were plenty of Cyber Troopers VO machines. The first one, those appeared to be very popular among the old school guys. And I used to go down to the arcade and watch guys come on the weekend, and they would just play VO for hours. And these were people that have been playing VO since 1995. And so VO is, near as I can tell, having played quite a bit of it now, it's more akin to a fighting game than anything, even though it doesn't have fighting game moves. It's a 3D two-robot battle in a limited-size arena where you have complete freedom of movement, Virtua Fighter 2 style. You're much more mobile with your robots than the big kind of clunky Sega fighters are. But the techniques you're still using are all about anticipating where your opponent's going to be next. It's all about footsies kind of stuff. You're really doing fighting game things with literal tank controls. It sounds unappealing, but it's incredibly awesome to play. And the nice bit about playing with Japanese arcade players in a very general sense was that a lot of them took more interest in teaching me than in whipping me. Hmm. Like they all knew they could destroy me, but they were all often very, very generous with tips and tricks and training to help you get better. I could have had my own Karate Kid arc with VO, I think, in Japan when I lived there, had I chosen to. And I sort of wish I had. So that's a game that to this day, when I go back to Japan, I look for. It's very hard to find now, and it's no fun at all with one person. You need two. Hmm. But if you have two people, it's a blast.
All right. I don't have friends, so I will never be able to play it the way it was meant to be, but I'm glad for you. I'm happy for you and your social life.
I'll play
it. Enjoy it. I guess I could play with a friend of me. Sure. So Kevin,
okay. I'm not smiling.
We can't tell. You look like a gear. You're so mechanical.
There is a Saturn port if you want to try that. It even came with a customized controller just for playing Virtual.
Can you do like PlayStation and link two systems together to go head-to-head?
I've never tried that.
Is it possible? You know, I don't know if Saturn can do that.
I remember there is a version of Virtual on for Saturn that I think had online play or something. So.
It may have had online. Yeah. Yeah.
Sounds right.
On a 14.4 modem? Good times.
Yeah,
by the time I got there, that stuff was long dead, so I just fooled around with it and bought the controller.
I've really only played the arcade one, and because I've seen it around at a couple arcades in the U.S. even, and it is a lot of fun.
I didn't realize it ever came out here. I had no idea.
I think they imported the cabs.
Oh, okay. All right, Kevin, tell us about Don Pachi, the famous mafia ruler.
So this is
going
the
down
first...
in a hail of bullets.
What a way to go. A hail of B bullets. So this is the first game in the Dodonpachi series from Cave. I don't remember if Cave had really done a whole lot before that, before this, but this is really, I think, the game that put them on the map.
Cave came out of what company? There were a few companies like Eating, Rising, Cave. They all sort of came around at the same time, and I want to say that they migrated and formed their own company from other studios, but because I did not prepare for that particular point, I don't know what they were.
Yeah,
caves are sort of a natural limestone formation from mineralization over millions of years.
So Micronix is what you're saying.
Yes.
Ex-Micronix developers.
Yeah, I intended to dig into Cave a bit more, and then I forgot, because it's that kind of morning. I like what I did. But anyway, yeah, Dodonpachi, this was published by Atlus, of all companies. Reportedly, Atlus wanted them to make something in the vein of a Toaplan shooter. Toaplan had just closed up shop.
That's probably where Cave came from now that I think about it.
The previous year. So the developers made an attempt at that. They consider that they failed miserably at making a game like Toaplan would have, but it was pretty popular, as it turned out. It's a vertical shooter, and it has a lot of bullets, which was just really starting to come into its own as a design mentality, like filling the screen with a lot of things you have to maneuver around, and you have a tiny little hitbox on your ship that you can use to get around these things without getting blasted constantly. It also has a chaining mechanic, which is sort of how you get high scores in this game. You have to shoot things within a certain time limit to keep your chain up, and your scores get multiplied over time. It's a very interesting game. There's a lot of cave traditions that start here, like having a true final boss and a second loop that like has revenge bullets coming at you whenever you shoot enemies, that sort of thing. It's pretty cool. I think it actually holds up pretty well. I don't think it's quite as popular as the next game, like Dodonpachi, is today, but I think it's very approachable. It's probably the easiest game in that series too, so
all right.
Well worth checking.
So I looked it up, and yes, Toaplan went on. The people at Toaplan, after its closure, went on to form Eating, Tamsoft, Cave, Gazelle, and Takumi. So, yep, that's probably why they said, "Hey, can you make us a Toaplan style game?" Because they were basically saying, "We are hiring you to do what you do."
Yeah, and they did it very poorly, but in a way that people liked.
I've never heard of any of these companies for some reason. All Japanese stuff, huh?
Yeah, you're not really into the Japanese Danmaku arcade scene, I think. So that probably explains it.
It never came to Gatlinburg, so if it wasn't in Gatlinburg, I don't know about it.
That's the problem.
Yeah.
Danpachi's a delightful game. I agree with Kevin that the Dodonpachi is definitely the superior of the two, but it's really worth playing even today. I think it's forgiving enough compared to most later bullet hell type shooters that that it can be a good point of entry for that sick and broken hobby of playing those. And I recommend it to anyone for that.
There are dozens of us fans.
Oh, I love vertical shooters.
All right, so Kevin, you signed up for a lot of arcade stuff. Tell us about Real Bout Fatal Fury and Ultimate Mortal Kombat 3, neither of which are Fatal Fury 3.
That's true. So, but I will have to talk about Fatal Fury 3 a bit because Fatal Fury 3 came out very early in 95. Its development cycle was disrupted by an earthquake, so it didn't really get to be fine-tuned and bug-fixed to the extent they wanted it to. It came out kind of a mess. So they kind of took another crack at that sort of game with Real Bout Fatal Fury. So it has a lot of the same sprite elements, graphical elements from Fatal Fury 3. It has some tweaks to the game engine to make it a little more interesting, a little less rough. But it also continues the story in such a way that is, I think, a lot more interesting. It's nowhere near as broken as Fatal Fury 3 to actually play. It's not very janky in comparison, but it's really cool. They brought back a lot of fun characters from the previous Fatal Fury games, because like Fatal Fury 3 only brought back like the main three, Terry, Andy, Joe, and Mai, and for Real Bout, they're like, okay, we can actually get some of the other characters people like in here. We can have a lot more of these funky new characters. We'll bring in some of the bosses from Fatal Fury 3 as like playable characters that were popular. I think like all the Real Bout Fatal Fury games are very well considered, and I feel like the first one kind of gets overlooked a lot, but it's a really cool game. It has some like really fun graphical flourishes too, like there's ring outs in it, and when you ring out somebody, there's every stage has like little animations depending on what happens to them as you push them out of the fighting arena. Like my favorite is getting someone knocked into a train and the train leaves the station and they're just like looking out the window. Like, hey. Yeah. Cool game.
So they threw in a lot of returning characters, but I feel like they probably had to calibrate that so it didn't step on King of Fighters toes, right? Because they were drawing from kind of the same pool of characters to a degree. Obviously, King of Fighters drawing from a bigger pool.
Right, yeah. Fatal Fury, they brought back characters. Like, I think they brought back Kim from Fatal Fury 2 in this one, which he showed up in King of Fighters from 1994 on, but they also brought in, oh god, who else was I thinking of? Was it Duck King, yes, who didn't show up in KOF until, like, 2005. Billy Kane showed up in this one from the... He also showed up in KOF 95, so like they were just really pushing Billy.
Yeah. So how does that game differ from Ultimate Mortal Kombat 3?
They're pretty
much the same thing, right?
Oh yeah, one-to-one. Ultimate Mortal Kombat 3, I would argue it was the last good Mortal Kombat game, and I'm sure most people would probably agree.
Hence the name Ultimate.
Yes. So this was, Capcom loved issuing revisions of their Street Fighter 2 games. This is Midway's version of that for Mortal Kombat 3, which was like fine but kind of rough. This one like adds in things that were missing. So they brought back, I think Kano came back in this one that he was missing. Or no, Kano was in MK3. Never mind on that. They brought back like Sub-Zero with a mask and a couple other hidden characters. They rebalanced everyone. There's like a 2-on-2 team battle mode. But just in general, this game actually, it holds up a lot better than the other early Mortal Kombat games. There's a surprising amount of depth to the combat and the combo system. It has like a like these little chain combo things that you could do.
Kevin, you said you regarded it as the last good one. I mean, are you including things like from 9 on in that? Like, do you actually not like the modern ones either?
I mean, I think they're fine.
Okay, I wondered.
I just think this one's better.
Okay, cool. Is that can you qualify that a little bit? I'm very interested.
So Ultimate MK3, it's a very fast game compared to the newer ones, particularly the last couple are kind of slow paced the way they wind up playing. Whereas a match in this one, it flies by.
Cool.
And I one thing that's very interesting to me about this is that so this game is still reasonably popular. It still gets a fair amount of play, even today, especially online. And I guess recently, the past few years, people have started digging into the frame data of how all the characters' moves work. And they kind of realize that, oh, this one character, Melina, we thought she was really bad. Only she's actually really, really good because she can punish a lot of things that no one else can. So as someone who played Melina in this game back in the day as one of my characters, it's very rewarding to see what was once the worst character in the game now be considered one of the best.
That's really cool. Thanks, Kevin.
So, like, just by playing as Melina, no one understood that she was good, except you, I guess. But
no, I was terrible with her, too.
Oh, okay. So, like, people didn't understand how to use the character until they hacked the game?
More like they didn't realize that, I think it's her roll move, where she just sort of rolls along on the ground like Sonic the Hedgehog. They didn't realize just how fast that came out until they were able to sort of dig into, you know, the game frame by frame. They're like, okay, so this is a lot faster than we thought it was. It's a lot faster than a lot of other moves in the game. Oh, also, all of these other moves that we thought were, like, reasonably safe against everything else in this game, turns out there's just enough of a window to punish them that she can do it, and other characters can't.
So does she just have, like ridiculous priority? Is that it? Like,
I think it's just speed.
Okay.
Yeah. There was a period, like, gosh, 15 years ago now, that makes me feel old, that some friends and I were playing the crap out of the Nintendo DS port of this game, which was really, really good. That was sort of the last time I really dug into it, but, you know, every so often I get to mess around with it and see what's going on, and I appreciate that it's still kicking.
So that was the arcade scene. Now we have an hour left to talk about computers and consoles. What have we done, gentlemen?
All right, our usual tomfoolery.
I know. Let's blitz through here. Talk about computers. Here's a list. Beavis and Butthead in Virtual Stupidity. Command and Conquer. Kind of surprised no one put their name next to this one. Crusader. No Remorse. Descent. Destruction Derby. Discworld. Empire 2. Exile, Escape from the Pit, Flight of the Amazon Queen, Full Throttle, Heroes of Might and Magic, in this economy, Hexen, I Have No Mouth and I Must Scream, Lemmings 3D, Mech Warrior 2, Civ Meyer Civnet, Simtown, Space Quest 6, Terminal Velocity, The 11th Hour, The Dig, The Journeyman Project 2, Terminator Future Shock, Ultimate Doom, Warcraft 2, Worms, and XCOM Terror from the Deep. This is not an all-inclusive list. This is just a slice, a sampling, to give you an idea of what delights and marvels awaited those who preferred to play video games on their personal computer. But let's dig into a handful of these. Jared, this is your section, where you're going to tell us about Descent, MechWarrior 2, and Worms. And somewhere in there, Benj is going to get a word in edgewise about Ultimate Doom. Actually, Benj, you've been very quiet. I'm putting you on the spot. You have to talk about Ultimate Doom now. Do it.
Go for it.
God, don't do this to me.
Yes,
man.
Yep.
I knew it.
Let's hear you Benjing.
Okay, let's see.
And then we can purge.
Yeah. Oh, God. Don't get me started with that one.
I'm sure you heard it a lot growing up.
Yeah. I used to make a joke about I had a brother named Purge. Anytime people would be like, Benj, what is that?
You should actually go to Portland Retro Gaming Expo, and it could be Benj at Purge.
That would be cool, yeah. I'd get a button made and wear it on my lapel.
Do it. Okay, so
Ultimate Doom is, you know, the ultimate version of Doom, which came out in 1993.
Wow, it's very sad that they made no more versions of Doom
it's
ever.
Like Ultimate Mortal Kombat 3, it's just the best one ever. No, not really, but I, you know, it's got the first three episodes of Doom, first there was a shareware episode, and if you registered it, you'd get two more episodes, and then they added a fourth episode called Thy Flesh Consumed, which is very difficult compared to the others. And I think it, you know, brings the double barrel shotgun into the original Doom, if I recall. I remember buying this, you know, Doom 2 had the double barrel shotgun first, which came out in 94. And so it's just, you know, it's Doom, which everybody knows about. Doom is great and this is awesome, but it has an extra episode, basically. So that's about, you know, there's not much to say unless you want to talk about Doom, which I think everybody knows about. First-person shooter Doom. So
yeah, I mean, we don't have to go too much into detail on that. The premise, I think, is understood. It's a cultural touchstone. But was this also the one that had a bunch of like user-made episodes in it, or was that a different release?
That is Final Doom, I believe. Oh,
which is different than Ultimate Doom, even though Ultimate means final.
Yeah, okay. Which is weird. Yeah,
thanks, Ed.
But yeah,
so we should
have
called this Penultimate Doom.
Doom on the PlayStation had, I think it had the Ultimate Doom, and then Final Doom had, I don't know, Doom 2 and Final Doom in it. So something like that. The PlayStation versions are pretty good of these. But, you know, I bought the boxed version of Ultimate Doom because I thought it was a great retail release with a big box. And I got Ultimate Doom and Doom 2 probably in 95, and I still have them. I used to have them on my shelf behind me. I'm looking, but they're not there anymore. I don't know where I put them. But I think that's one of the most important things about this was that it was a high-profile retail release of Doom, which was largely published by GT Interactive instead of self-published by id. And I don't remember who did the original retail Doom. Maybe the GT Interactive too. So just read John Romero's book. It's really good. That's all I got to say.
Yeah, that's a really special thing about this. I'm glad you pointed that out. You know, for those of us on the PC side that didn't buy the box copy, our Doom collections were like a collection of floppy disks, usually the shareware disk, and then maybe something we ordered from id, and then three WAD files that we got from a friend at school, and a pirated copy of Doom 2, and maybe some user maps. And these were all like just on your desk in seven different fonts on five different colors, or you could just buy this box thing and get everything and more for, at that point, a really, really low price. It was a great deal.
Yeah, it was like, I was really proud to have a retail copy of Doom, which I loved so much, you know, and I got, when I first met John Romero at some conference, I got him to sign the CD, and I do have that in my shelf over here. So I'm still proud of it. It's just, it's a cool release of a wonderful game.
It's cool.
That's all I got to say.
All right. It's time for the Jared Show. Jared, regale us. Tell us about these personal computer pastimes of yours.
1995 was a hell of a year to have a PC. It sure was. And Descent was a big part of that for me. Any of the three you played Descent before?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So,
yes, but I played it on a Macintosh, which I guess people didn't call a PC back then. But I even bought a crazy Wingman flight stick for it, because otherwise trying to navigate those 3D spaces just seemed like a lot to ask.
So you bought a flight stick just for Descent. That's awesome.
I did. And I still wasn't any good at it.
The keyboard controls are crazy. You know, I couldn't figure it out. It was amazing to be in 3D and moving around and stuff, but it confused me a lot when I played.
Yeah, for those who have no context in this, so I understand that like in 1993, Doom comes out, and that's just a flat plane and then fakes up and down on stairwells and passages you just auto in. You know, then we get, you know, we've got Quake coming around, but in the middle of all this where Quake allows us to aim up and down, Descent instead is just like, nah, that's for babies. You can fly up, down, sideways, left, right. You're effectively a helicopter that doesn't have to worry about staying stable. And then you're going, instead of through big open spaces, through tiny little twisting and branching mine tunnels. So you're traveling around the inside of like the vents from Alien in a fast, heavily armed tank that can go any direction. And ambushes, multiplayer, like in Descent in particular, was beautiful because you just do like the Star Trek II thing. You know, the Reliant goes by and the Enterprise just rises up behind it and blows it away. I have done that so many times in Descent, and it feels great.
You have to play against people with two-dimensional thinking. Exactly. But it's worth mentioning that you couldn't just go in any direction. You could orient yourself in any direction. This all took place in space. So there was no gravity to speak of. There's, you know, some inertia, but even that's kind of muted for the sake of enjoyment. But it becomes very disorienting very quickly because you have to, you know, navigate through all these tunnels. It's not like, you know, you're in a big room and there's tunnels branching off to the right, left, et cetera. Like they go off in the ceiling and the floor and they twist around and you have to keep kind of orienting yourself and rotating and moving on all three axes. And it gets really hard to keep up with. It's really, really like just kind of mind blowing that they did this at that time. This was a year before Quake even came out. So
yeah, it's incredible.
They were on something.
I honestly don't know how Descent's not still around. It's such a good formula that I think it could still work.
I think it's just too demanding, too complex. Like trying to navigate truly three-dimensional space, that's not something that video games make you do very often.
Remember Colony Wars? Colony Wars on the PlayStation reminds me of Descent a little bit. You can maneuver in any direction, like orient yourself.
That was Psygnosis, right?
I don't remember, so but I just like, remember it was good.
Yeah. A cooler looking version that doesn't play as it doesn't have the same substance is my guess.
It was, Descent also, you know, had. Oh, go ahead.
No, no, you can talk about Descent. Colony Wars is just cool. It was a space shooter. I remember Descent being more corridor oriented. Isn't that right, Jared?
Yeah, you're largely indoors or in large rooms sometimes that are arena like, but so a lot of times you're in narrow tunnels and it alters enough. The stages are, the maps are really well designed. The enemies are great. They're very simple, like polygons, but they're colored and shaded in such a way that they look menacing. Lots of bladed edges. And so in the dark, they're actually kind of scary sometimes. And then multiplayer makes the game. It is a deathmatch paradise. It's one of the best deathmatch FPSs I've ever played. Descent, play it if you never have, because you will not be disappointed. My take, most of my friends played with joysticks. I played with mouse and keyboard, and that made me better than them, I learned. I think Descent is hard to learn mouse and keyboard, but it's easier to manipulate the 3D space with that than it is with a stick. That was my, but that took, you know, again, I played it too much. So I'm monopolizing here. Our second game, MechWarrior 2.
I feel like this is the game that comes in between your other two games. Like you're going from mech based 3D space shooter with a multiplayer component to something that's more mech based and tactical to something that's tactical.
Yeah. MechWarrior, you're steering around you're not controlling a battlefield. Like you are still in a cockpit, but there's a very small number of moving pieces on that map every scenario, and you need to be acutely aware of where your allies and enemies are at every second, or you are dead after the first few missions. It is very dependent on the right. As much of it's about building and customizing your mech before a battle as anything, making sure you've got the right equipment, the right gear for when something unexpected pops up that you're not surprised by it and you're ready. You feel so good when you prep in just the right way. It's, you know, if anybody's familiar with BattleTech, the tabletop game, MechWarrior is just a first-person version of that. And I've played most of the MechWarrior games now, and I still think MechWarrior 2 is my favorite. I don't think it ever hit the balance of complexity and playability as well as they did with MechWarrior 2. Everything after got more complex.
Wasn't BattleTech just the Robotech machines that FASA could get a license for?
I don't know the Valkyries? I don't know the history behind FASA's licenses with them. Most of them are ground vehicles. There is Aerotech that are fighters, and there's even a few transforming ones that look suspiciously like Macross, the Phoenix Hawks. But I don't know the history there for the
license. Yeah, I thought BattleTech was like all the support mechs and stuff that you see like on the deck of the Macross or the SDF-1, you know, like the kind of the beige bipedal mechs with the cannons on the back and that sort of thing.
They're a lot like that, but there's about a million models of them, and they're all very customizable. And so what you do is you destroy enemies, collect the parts from their destroyed mechs, then you go to the second game, which is mech customization, managing your mercenary team, etc. Then you go back in. You know, it's fun. It's got that kind of XCOM thing where you prep for the battle, you go to the battle, you reap the rewards, you come back, you do it all again. Triple PPCs for life. That's the armament choice. And turn on that infrared mode the second you got it. They never turn it off because it looks really cool. It's vectory. It almost has a Star Wars arcade look when you go to infrared. I like that. And then finally, I've been monopolizing.
You take away the mech suits, and inside it's just squishy little guys.
Everybody loves Worms with good reason. I grew up playing simple artillery games on old computers. Then I played, you know, Scorched Earth, and then I played Worms. And Worms is the one that has endured. Turn-based, shoot things in an arc to heal your friends, taunt them across the room, couch, competitive multiplayer. That's just what everyone needs in life. Okay, that's all I have to say about Worms.
It's a good game.
That's it.
It's weird.
I like Scorched Earth better. Sorry.
It's weird that I missed Worms, given that I remember playing a lot of Scorched Earth with a friend of mine in school. So
that's because it's better.
Scorched Earth is better than Worms, but Worms is the one that we still have. So that's what
true. I do. Yeah.
It's really hard to play Scorched Earth now. Where upon Worms, you can still grab for just about anything.
I've never played Scorched Earth, but I do like the Von der Graf Generator song.
Pretty sure you can still buy Scorched Earth off of the guy's website, as an aside.
Wendell Hicken.
Like the guy who made it. I think he still sells it.
Wow. That's truly... I should buy that.
Right? Wendell Hicken. That's his name.
Okay, so that was the personal computer side of things. I think we were just kind of on the cusp of PC gaming really, really exploding into the mainstream, which would happen a few years later. But this is when, you know, 3D accelerators and hardware-based acceleration began to sort of trickle into the market. And once that really caught hold, suddenly PCs were not limited by, you know, their graphics cards and their systems. And could really realize the potential, their potential as gaming machines. But we weren't quite there yet. Instead, 1995 was the year of consoles. I put down a list of all the consoles on the US market that I could think of. I might have missed one or two, but this might be the most saturated the American console market has ever been with choices. It utterly eclipses like the peak of the Atari 2600 era. It makes that look like baby toys. There were so many systems in active circulation with active publisher and developer support in 1995. You had the Super NES, the Genesis, the 3DO, the CDI, if you want to call that a console, the Game Boy, the Jaguar, the Game Gear, the Lynx, the Neo Geo, the Virtual Boy, the PC and TurboGrafx-16, the PlayStation, Saturn, and I guess if you want to consider like Sega CD a separate platform and Jaguar CD.
32X.
32X, baby. The
32X.
That was that year too. Oh man, I forgot about that.
Get PC Engine or sorry, Turbo CD in there, and that's a dozen systems being supported on the market. It was time, my friends, for a shakeout. And the first to fall would be Virtual Boy. Deservedly so.
I was gonna say this
talk
was,
about that.
This was very much in that period of almost crash that hit the video game space. So
yeah, the 16-bit market got clobbered around this time as the price of carts increased, and there were just so many games and consoles out there that sales dropped off a cliff for everything except the big hits.
And like economically, it was a bad time because Japan was in the middle of its lost decade, and the yen was still strong in 95, which means that, you know, sales overseas weren't really bringing in a lot of cash. So it was just a bad time for the companies making the games, but it was a great time if you wanted to play games.
So I have a long list here of console games, and we're going to talk about a few of these. A lot of them we've already talked about in previous episodes. There is no logical sequence to this, no alphabetical sequence. I don't know how I put this list together. I might have been stoned. No, I don't do drugs. I might have been drunk. Might have been on melatonin. I might have just been stupid. I don't know.
Delish.
But here we go. Buckle in, kids. This is Jeremy's unbridled id in list making. And I don't mean it as in Doom. But you are doomed. Clay Fighter 2. The Ignition Factor. Pack in Time. Not by Pack and Soft. The Mega Man 2X. Brandish. Metal Warriors. Kirby's Avalanche. Ogre Battle, Hagane, Earthbound, Chrono Trigger, Primal Rage, Dracula X, Mega Man 7, Booger Man, Yoshi's Island, aka Super Mario World 2, The Secret of Evermore, Donkey Kong Country 2, Breath of Fire 2, Final Fight 3, Alien Soldier, actually I don't think that one came to the US, Barkley, Shut Up and Jam, The Death and Return of Superman, Phantasy Star 4, Ristar, Beyond Oasis, Crusader of Senti, Echo Jr., The Adventures of Batman and Robin, X-Men 2, Clone Wars, Light Crusader, Comics Zone, Weapon Lord, Vector Man, Garfield, Caught in the Act, Gargoyles, Spider-Man Separation Anxiety, Spot Goes to Hollywood, Earthworm Jim 2, Toy Story, Toshinden, Jumping Flash, Rayman, Ridge Racer, Road Rash, Viewpoint, Twisted Metal, Zoop, Wipeout, Mario's Picross, Kirby's Dream Land 2, Donkey Kong Land, Street Fighter 2, Game Boys, Chicago Syndicate, Foreman for Real, Cannon Fodder, Syndicate, Theme Park, Double Dragon 5, White Man Can't Jump, Flashback, Atari Carts, Return Fire, The Daedalus Encounter, Scramble Cobra, Quarterback Attack with Mike Ditka, Advanced Dungeons... I can't keep this up. Advanced Dungeons and Dragons, Brain Dead 13, Panic Bomber, Puzzle Bobble, Fire Pro Joshi. We're in the Japanese stuff here. Aicho Aniki, Galaxy Fraulein Yuna 2, Asuka 120% Maximum, Linda Cube, Sapphire. Who put this stuff on here? Red Alarm, Pelero Boxer, Mario Clash, Jack Brothers, Innsmouth no Yakata, Wario Land, Virtual Boy, and Virtual Lab.
So that's how your brain works, huh?
I guess.
That's actually, like I think, a map.
I think these were kind of by platform, actually, just not alphabetical. I don't know. I make no defense here, but if you managed to follow that, congratulations. I couldn't.
Panzer Dragoon being besmirched here. I'm so sad.
I understood every word, Jeremy.
Okay, good. I didn't. What was that all about?
It's like a peon to the peon to the whatever that word is to the okay. Lost. The lost age of video game excellence.
That's so cool. Okay, anyway.
This is a really good list of games. We could easily talk about these forever. I mean, like Puzzle Bobble. Oh, my God. Like, even Street Fighter 2 Game Boy, I think, is cool. There's Dream Land 2. I mean, God, this is a great list.
You should have signed up for some of those, but you didn't.
I mean, this would be 10 hours long, this podcast.
Say time for a 24-hour live stream of just going through 95's game roster.
That would actually be kind of fun if I could... No, let's not.
Enough drugs.
Right. Kevin Bunch, tell us about Earthbound.
Oh, boy. I feel like there's not a lot I have to say about Earthbound that people can't just find out at this point. But for me, this is a particularly...
I think that's true of just about anything on this list, though. Just,
I don't know.
Wikipedia.
I feel like people don't know enough about Booger Man to, for their everyday life. It's a pick-and-flick adventure, you know. But as for Earthbound, this game was kind of special to me because I didn't really play a lot of RPGs at this time. Like, I played Dragon Warrior because I got it for free, and I really enjoyed it, but I wasn't really into sort of like sword and sorcery fantasy type settings. So I kind of bounced off of a lot of everything that came after that point.
But baseball and baseball bat and psychic power fantasies.
Yeah, you put me in something that was like a contemporary setting with like weird stuff and aliens and psychic powers, and I was intrigued by this. And I remember renting it a fair bit, and eventually, like, I got a copy of it for Christmas because they couldn't give these things away, and my mom realized this. And I played the living daylights out of it, and so did my brother. I think he might have actually played it more than I did, but it's like such a weird and like funny and charming game. It has a very like particular sense of humor that comes through very well in the localization. Mechanically, I don't think it's super like special, but it has some like great ideas in there for how you handle random encounters and how you deal with random encounters when you're dramatically stronger than the enemies, that I really wish that more games in the genre had taken a hint from.
You can modify your consumables to upgrade their abilities, to their like healing power. And you that by adding ketchup to your hamburger. So it's done in a way that's like very intuitive and extremely American.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's funny in that sense, because it's very much like, here's sort of a pastiche of, like, Western culture, but...
Suburbia.
Yeah, suburbia seen through a very, like, particularly weird lens.
It's the only game I've ever played that lets me call my dad on the phone to this day.
Yeah.
I feel like there should be more dad calling.
And he'll tell you how much money he put in your bank account.
Yeah. I wish my dad would still do that.
I don't know.
Yeah.
That's kind of the plot of Final Fantasy X.
That's a good point.
Yeah, fair enough.
Well said.
So yeah, between this and Chrono Trigger, like it was a good time for me as someone coming back around to RPGs.
Binge, I feel like you were trying to say something in there.
Yeah, I have an Earthbound story. Did I ever tell you the Earthbound story? I don't remember.
I don't know.
Retronauts over the years.
Is it the greatest story ever told?
It is, but it's very brief. So first of all, it's interesting that I got Earthbound. I bought it used from Blockbuster. You know, it was one of their previously rented games. I used to get a lot of games. I got Legend of Zelda, Link to the Past that way. Some of their good stuff. But I just had the box and the cartridge, and I never had the manual, sadly. So anyway. But in 1996, I think it was August or September, we had this horrible hurricane called Hurricane Fran that came through North Carolina, and I'm in Raleigh, and you know, we were expecting a hurricane to happen, but we didn't know how bad it would be inland, because normally it would just blast the coast and not have much effect, you know, 200-300 miles inland.
Yeah, so that happens sometimes.
We, you know, my brother and I were up late. I think school was preemptively canceled, and I was playing video games, and I was playing Earthbound all through the night while, you know, the storm swirled and dumped rain on us, and trees began to crash down around us. We lived in a wooded lot. We had like acres of forest around us, basically. And all through the night, this crashing of trees coming down while I was playing Earthbound until the power went out, you know, finally at like 3 a.m. or something. And it was just such a dramatic night and such an interesting memory, because I absolutely love this game. It's one of my favorites of all time. And I beat it in a really weird way later. Even though it's one of my favorites back then, I sort of gave up on it at the time and revisited it later by dumping the save game onto an emulator and playing it on an old iMac, like on my bedside with an emulator. And then I finally finished it later, like many, many years, like 2006 or something. And I wrote about it on my blog at the time on vintagecomputing.com. Anyway, it's just such an interesting game that has so much, I don't know if pathos is the right word, but there's a lot of like, you know, just like the Mother 3 is like crazy like that. There's a lot of emotion packed into it. But Earthbound also has a lot of this sort of packed in, you know, humor and emotional turns just in such a unassuming looking game with a, you know, unassuming looking setting. But it's very deep and very masterfully done. It's just one of the greatest games of all time. So I highly recommend it. Like Kevin, I was not huge into the sword and sorcery RPGs other than I played Dragon Warrior a lot on the NES or something. But this, I never got into Final Fantasy really or anything, but I loved Earthbound just because of the setting and the music is so quirky and cool. And anyway, so there's my Earthbound story. It may be the second time I've told it on Retronauts. I don't know.
I don't think I've heard that one before.
Okay. There you go.
So well done. Thank you for the fresh content. And speaking of fresh content, here's Jeremy talking about Brandish. So Brandish, what a weird game. You guys have played it before, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So
I think so.
It started as a PC game in Japan, like a PC 88 game, developed by Nihon Falcom, published here for Super NES by Koei, and I think kind of widely misunderstood back when the Gaming Intelligence Agency had a fundraiser. They had a thing called the Gauntlet of Pain, where if they could hit certain tiers, certain goals, someone would write a game about a terrible RPG. And I signed up for Brandish thinking, okay, sure. And I played it and realized, oh, this actually is not bad. This is really good. And it takes a little while to get used to the perspective, but it's not bad. It is a dungeon crawler in the purest sense. You like get dropped down into a deep pit and have to crawl your way out, fighting your way out. The weird thing about it is that your protagonist always faces forward. It's kind of like, what if you had tank controls, but instead of your character moving relative to the screen moved relative to your character. So anytime you turn, the screen, the dungeon, rotates 90 degrees around you. It's disorienting. I think it makes more sense in the PSP remake, The Dark Revenant, which came out like, I guess it was like 15 years later. The Dark Revenant, you know, because it's a 3D game, it allowed the dungeon to rotate around you as opposed to just jumping 90 degrees. And it's a weird choice because, you know, like, it's a strange way to put a player into the midst of the game. But once you connect with it, it does work. And it's really good and thoughtful, like, sort of a meatier version of the dungeons in Ys, where you like, the entire ecosystem takes place in the dungeon. So you can recover health in the dungeon over time, but you do have to watch out because if you rest too long, an enemy will come up behind you, find you sleeping, and kill you. It's weird to me that they have like the 90 degree rotation thing when this was a game on Super NES, which had built in hardware level support for rotating backgrounds. Like, did you guys not make that connection? And I think the game probably would be liked a lot better if it had, you know, that one feature, but basically, you just have to fight your way up, and there's different zones in the dungeon. Like, you eventually get to a zone that is entirely dark, and you have to kind of stumble your way through until you can find a light source of some sort. It's just, yeah, it's a very chewy, kind of challenging, just pure combat-oriented RPG with an action element to it. Really, really good and interesting. And there were several sequels. There was Brandish 2, the Planet Buster. That's a sword that's so powerful, it breaks the planet. That never came to the US, though it did come to Super Famicom. And then there was, I think, a Brandish 3 and maybe 4 that were only for PCs. And those were really late in those systems' lifespans. I mean, by the mid-90s, Japan had pretty much started to migrate over to Windows. And, you know, the homegrown PCs like the PC 98 and the X68000 had all started to taper off. And so these were kind of like the last men standing on the Japanese PC systems. But
Jeremy,
obviously those have never come here.
Was it on like the Marty or the 9800 or what was it on? Like the late ones.
I thought they were on PC 98.
On 98,
maybe,
okay.
Maybe they're on the Towns Marty. I don't know.
Cool. I was wondering. I love Brandish. You once described it as a solipsism simulator.
Mm-hmm.
The world rotates around you. And I thought
yes,
that was
I specifically did not use that line here because I've used it before. But yes, that is my very clever line. Thank you for reminding the world.
No problem. You're a pretty clever guy. I think the world should be reminded whenever possible.
That's an extra 50% payment on this episode for you.
He's a genius. He's an absolute genius.
it only works once. Sorry, you blew it.
Damn it.
Anyway, yeah, Brandish. Good, weird. Play it on PSP if you can. But you know, it's Falcom, so it's quirky and strange, but good once you get your head around it, and has a great soundtrack. Anyway, let's talk about something totally different. Oh no, it's another RPG. Jared, tell us about Chrono Trigger.
Yeah,
we did just have a live episode about this, but. Bring something fresh to the table, something we wouldn't have thought of.
Oh, good Lord. I doubt I can do that about Chrono Trigger. There are no surprises to be found in Chrono Trigger for those who are listening to Retronauts. None whatsoever. It's just great. And it's wonderful. And for all the reasons you've already heard, a long time ago, I think the very first Retronauts episode about Chrono Trigger was held back in the 1UP days. And, Scott Cherokee was a frequent contributor to that. And Scott said that what he thought of Chrono Trigger was it was like someone had taken and made a list of everything he hated in RPGs and then took all that out and just left the good stuff. And I do think that distilled is a good way to think about Chrono Trigger. It does do some things that at the time were amazing new ideas that hadn't been seen before, but much more it's an act of refinement. It's taking genre conventions and saying, how do we just purposefully make these the most fun, the most colorful, the most joyful, the most frightening we possibly can? And they hit a secret sauce there. I breaking down what produced the extraordinarily successful product Chrono Trigger is would be beyond the powers of anyone that couldn't interview the creators for hours and hours and hours and hours and hours. But somehow they managed to make just about everything fun. And in a hobby that I really love, I've played thousands of games over the years, I can't think of one with less tension as related to depth than Chrono Trigger. It's a very accessible game with a ton of meat to it. That's fairly rare. So,
yeah. I love it. I think it's wonderful. Greatest RPG of all time, asterisk. Okay, so let's talk about something that's not an RPG. Chris Sims signed up to talk about Mega Man 7, but he's not here, so I can just say they shouldn't have. All right, Binge, tell us about Yoshi's Island, Super Mario World 2.
By the way, just as an aside, I think Chrono Trigger is John Romero's favorite game, isn't it? Like he's always cited it as one of his favorites.
That explains Anachronox, or no. Was it Anachronox? Yeah.
No, that was Tom Hall's game, isn't it?
Oh, okay.
I wonder if John is Frog in his own headcanon.
Yeah.
That would explain why those are the enemies you have to fight in Daikatana.
It's probably. So. Okay. Yoshi's Island. Super Mario World 2.
Was that
Yoshi's
like Island. A Yoshi's imitation right there? That-
Yeah, that was unintentional, but it was probably like a Freudian slip.
No, I thought it sounded just spot on.
Awesome. So Yoshi's Island is another one of those games where this was probably the last new game I bought for the Super Nintendo, because it came out fairly late, October 4th, 1995 in America, I believe, August 95 in Japan. And it's, you know, it's not late for Japan. I guess they were making games for the Super Famicom till the 98 or so, right? But in America, it felt late because a lot of people were switching over to, you know, the 32-bit consoles and stuff.
32X, yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
Gotta play Star Wars Arcade.
Yoshi's Island is a very, for a long time, it was like the most interesting and unique Mario style, you know, Mario game. Now they've, you know, made follow-ups and remakes and stuff like that. But for a long time, just the art style, first of all, is what strikes you, because it looks like crayon drawings. And it was completely unique at the time. And it used a Super FX 2 chip, I believe. Mm-hmm. Like the, you know, the Super FX chip first was in Star Fox, right? Yeah. So this is like an enhancement of it that's probably faster, can do more effects. But it was great at scaling these, you know, big, beautiful sprites and stuff like that. And so it's just a graphically beautiful, gorgeous game. Colorful, fun to play, and you're controlling Yoshi, and you have baby Mario on your back, and if you get hit, baby Mario goes into a little bubble, and you have a timer before you die to recover baby Mario and get him back on your back to pop the bubble, and you're collecting things. It's sort of a collect-a-thon game in a way, and platformer, and
it's kind of the original. Well, no, I guess Donkey Kong Country.
Yeah. It feels even more than Donkey Kong Country. It feels like, you know, because there's so many things to collect, and it has that scoreboard at the end of every stage. And this is the first game where I was proud that I had 100%ed every stage in the first world or whatever, wow. You know, group. So
were you ever able to beat the bonus stage that unlocks when you get 100% in the first world?
I don't remember, but I do remember beating this game and loving it so much that I played it through, which was rare for, you know, like, focus. You know, I've recently found out that I have ADHD. Like, I got diagnosed maybe last year, and, like, that explains, like, the, you know, fidgeting every time Jeremy talks, pacing around, you know, looking away.
Okay, well, losing interest. As long as you're saying it's a you problem and not a me problem.
It's a diagnosed disorder. It's called retronauts disorder. Anyway, but this is one of those games that held my attention. You know, that's a rare thing. It held my attention all the way through. There's few games like that. Like Katamari Damacy is a game where I sat down and I played through the whole thing the first time I played it. Rampage on the NES, for some reason, I played through that. Probably you had Infinite Continues, but I played through that. And this is one of those games where I just basically played through it, like, just nonstop until I was done. And it's just a beautiful, wonderful game.
I will add that I have a 3-year-old, and this is one of the games he really likes having me play, I assume because he thinks it's very, like, colorful and very fun to look at. And also, he loves Yoshi, so that's also a factor. If this had Wario, he'd be set.
This is on that short list of video games that if you just say the name, I smile. I just feel happy inside when Yoshi's Island comes up. Conversation.
It has really good sound effects, by the way. They're really satisfying, like when you collect coins and hop and stuff and pound the ground. And also the music is really fun, and I think about the music pops into my head all the time. And it's just a great game. It's one of the best Super NES games. Anyway.
Yeah, you mentioned the Super FX 2 chip, and you know, one of the things that really stands out about Yoshi's Island is the fact that they had this powerful 3D coprocessor, much more powerful than the Super NES CPU in the cartridge. And unlike all the other games that made use of FX or FX2, they didn't use it for 3D elements. They used it for rotating and scaling sprites. So it maintains this hand-drawn look, but it has these wild, you know, effects that still look hand-drawn, but also manage to fill the screen and do all kinds of stuff that couldn't have been done before. And I feel like that sort of thing is pretty, you know, commonplace now because everyone picked up on this idea of, oh, we can scale and rotate sprites. And, you know, you've got everything from like Vanillaware marionette characters to just people abusing the idea of scaling and rotating sprites, but here it all feels very consistent, and it's always very surprising. You know, they throw all kinds of stuff at you, whether it's just like big guys who come out of the lava and chase you around, or giant doors that close, or what is those, like, big slabs that fall forward into the screen?
Oh, yeah, man.
The dungeons, and you have to avoid getting squashed. But then you'll do things like fight a raven on the surface of a moon, and the moon is barely bigger than the screen, and you're rotating the entire universe as you run around, like your perspective on the universe, as you run around the planetoid trying to get a one-up, you know, get one over on this raven by, like, punching things through the planet to pop it on the reverse side of the planet. It's just, it's so creative and so inventive. And even though all the bosses are just bigger versions of standard enemies, they always do something interesting with that. It's not like, you know, some of the Castlevania games where it's like, here is a skeleton, but now it is really big. It's like, here is that cute little puffy guy, but now he's huge and you have to, like, attack him until he breaks into little pieces, and then you take out the little guys and things like that. It's just, yeah, it's so pure and joyful. And people do complain about the collect-a-thon element of it, but you don't have to collect everything to beat the game. However,
it's still fun without it.
Yeah. However, if you really want to, like, really go for it, get all the flowers, all the red coins, and all the stars, and all the stages. Every time you do that in all the stages in a single world, you unlock bonus stages, which are unbelievably hard. Like, the first one I've never beaten, Poochie Ain't Stupid. I can tell you the name of it, because you have to ride around on that goddamn dog, and you don't have any direct control over him. So it's kind of like the character that you rely on for that stage is an agent of chaos who makes things harder for you, and you have to, like, plan all your platforming and action around him. There's also the fact, we didn't mention the fact that instead of going with kind of like the standard Mario attacks, because you're Yoshi, obviously you can eat enemies or spit them out, but you have the ability to chuck eggs. Like, Yoshi, yeah. Yoshi has an amazing egg production capacity, and eat an enemy, pop out an egg, just, you know, you can carry six around at a time, and there's a targeting cursor, and you can choose how you target, but you're throwing things, doing bank shots, and that factors into a lot of finding the secrets, defeating the bosses. It's a much slower paced Mario game, and kind of more complex in terms of its interface. Yeah. But it justifies that by just giving you a lot to do and making it always interesting. And the visuals definitely help with that, because every world has its own kind of visual style and is full of little fun surprises, like the monkeys eating coconuts who will, you know, throw things at you, but then you can steal a coconut and then spit seeds like a machine gun at the monkeys and they'll get mad and run off. I love this game.
The gameplay is incredible. I love that mechanic of the eggs. Like, I just loved it immediately. You can just, it feels powerful for some reason to take it, like, swallow an enemy and pop them into an egg, like, instantly. And I liked also the fact that I think in this game you can sort of, can't you touch some of the enemies, like the shy guys, without getting hurt? I can't remember. Like, it's more like you can kind of push them around.
There's some enemies that you can manipulate to a certain degree, but for the most part, it's kind of standard platformer rules where if you bump into a shy guy, it's going to mess you up and you'll lose Mario.
You can stand on his head or something. Is that what I'm thinking about?
No, because you got big old Yoshi clodhoppers. You've got gigantic shoes. So anything you jump on, it goes poof and pops.
Oh, yeah. So I'm thinking of something else, but this is like,
I'm thinking of Mario too.
Yeah, I'm just thinking, this is where my brain was going. I remember it now. I just like the fact that they put Shy Guys in this game from Super Mario Bros.
There's so many variants,
yeah,
too.
Yeah.
There's, like, the little guys with the spears, and you have to watch out for the spears because they're kind of unpredictable.
Yeah. I'm also thinking about pushing the rock around. You can push to get places. It's really cool. I love this game. But it feels like
And I'm
bonus.
Hearing the sound effect in my head as you do that.
Yeah, now. This feels like a bonus game Nintendo never had to make, and it probably cost them a ton of money to develop it and make those chips and everything. And it's just like, it's like Super Nintendo beautiful bonus extra.
It kind of makes me think of when they made Super Mario Brothers, the idea was we've got the stock Famicom NES ROM. This is what you can do on this system with no enhancements, no supplemental hardware. Let's put everything into this. And then, you know, a few months later, they came out with The Legend of Zelda, which was an entirely new peripheral that had all these new capabilities. So this kind of feels like they were saying, let's show what we can do with two-dimensional gaming. And then in 6 months, we're going to put out Super Mario 64. Mm-hmm. And that's going to, you know, take things in a totally new direction. So, yeah, it does feel like that kind of final statement by Nintendo. Like, we're kind of, you know, making our definitive effort here in this style of technology, this mode of technology. And as you can expect, you know, they poured decades of experience into it and created something amazing.
Indeed.
Yoshi's Island. Okay, let's talk about...
I have to force myself to stop talking about it. We can move on.
Let's see. Wow, there's a lot of comic book games that Chris Sims was going to talk about, but he's not around. So, wow. Kevin, you've already gone through your list, haven't you?
Gosh. I went in heavy on the arcade games. So,
you did. Okay, well, I guess it's over to Jared now to talk about Phantasy Star 4.
Yeah, because
we haven't talked about enough RPGs.
Exactly. I mean, we're looking at Chrono Trigger, so for the console war purpose, we've got to have the best RPG on the Genesis as well. And I do think that Phantasy Star 4, while well-recognized in lists and pantheons throughout the internet, as time has passed, is kind of a fading star, because Phantasy Star 4 is much, much, much more dependent than many RPGs on playing its predecessors to fully enjoy it. Phantasy Star 4 is very specifically a game made for people who played Phantasy Star 1 and 2. It is the third part of a trilogy, the culmination of a story, wraps everything up thematically. It ties into part 3 a very little bit, but the team that made this was really making the final game in the trilogy, so that number 4 is often very misleading. When you play it now, you'll see a competently done Genesis RPG with decent music, and if you play it for an hour, that's all you're going to get from it. However, if you play Phantasy Star 1 and enjoy it, and Phantasy Star 2 and enjoy it, then this game is a series of fan service delights, and not in the, you know, bad skirt flipped up, I just saw your underwear way, but in the good, wow, that's just a resounding retelling of something I already enjoyed that came out a different, surprising way. Like when you played Mega Man 9 and you're jumping from disappearing platforms and suddenly they do something you didn't expect because the developers were clever and they want to fool you. It kind of has that vibe to it, comparing it to 1 and 2, but in an RPG way. I'm probably completely blowing selling this to you. My point is that it's real well put together. It's decent-esquely translated. There are definitely some problematic moments in it that you'll know when you get to them. Nevertheless, it feels like the 5-year love letter that it was. It took 5 years for the Phantasy Star 2 team to complete Phantasy Star 4.
It's a good game.
Yeah, and it is just seeping with love. And that's what I really love about it.
This is one I got from Blockbuster. Another one, I think, previously viewed, and I loved it. And I wasn't, like I said, I wasn't big into these Japanese RPGs at the time. I didn't play through the whole thing, but I remember enjoying what I played of it. It felt like
was the fact
theme.
That it was space themed, did that help? Or
yeah,
or,
maybe that was it. Okay. You know,
that just would a do different it.
Yeah, I have Phantasy Star 1 on the Master System, and it's pretty cool too. I think I've played that.
Yeah, 1 is good, 2 is better, and 4 is the best. That's
yeah,
that's
4 is really cool.
And if you're my one friend in high school, you love 3 the best for some reason.
I don't want
you gotta
I would
be
not
that
be friends
guy.
With that friend anymore.
There's always that guy, you know?
There's always one.
Yeah. That's not acceptable. Liking Phantasy Star 3 is a crime against humanity. But yeah,
I don't think I'd go that far.
So, well, no, I wouldn't really either, but I like to say things I don't mean because it's better for the podcast. Mm.
Extreme.
Hyperbole never hurt anyone. Well, actually, it did, but that's yeah.
Not in this particular instance, I hope.
Yeah. So, Benj, why don't you take the lead on talking about a role-playing game and tell us about Light Crusader.
Oh, yeah. Light Crusader is cool. The funny thing about this is I don't think I played it until we, you know, there was like this Sega 30th anniversary collection of Genesis that you bought us a copy of, Jeremy, and we all talked about it for some reason.
That was so nice of me.
Yeah, it was nice. And I still have it. It's great. So Light Crusader was on that collection, and it's a Genesis game. Came out in 95, obviously, October of for North America, May for Japan. And it was, I don't know, it was developed by Treasure, yeah, who developed Gunstar Heroes and Dynamite Hitty. And, but it's, you know, it's an isometric role-playing game, and it feels a lot like, it's not a roguelike, it feels like it should be. It's like, feels a little bit like Diablo in a way, before Diablo. Although Diablo may, what year did Diablo come out? Maybe 95 even.
I think it was 96. 95.
Yeah, so it wasn't before Diablo, but it feels like a rare, deep, I don't know, it's almost Western-style feeling role-playing game to me instead of Japanese, because it's, I don't know, it's a fantasy sword and combat, and, you know, you've got a spell system with fire, water, earth, and wind, and you kind of solve puzzles and jump a little bit, I think. So it has some platforming elements that are frustrating and isometric stuff, but I just remember, like, I was just trying it randomly just to play the collection, but I actually ended up playing it for several hours, which is another one of those unique and rare things. So that's why I know it's either a good game or it's something that happened to attract me to it, you know. And it was mostly, it's like an action RPG, kind of. I think that's what attracted me to it. It wasn't just, like, random battles. It has the, you know, the action element, as in you move around and attack people with your sword, kind of like Zelda or something, and then it's got the RPG leveling, and that's what it is.
Hmm.
Yep. Good game.
I still should play this someday.
It's very underrated. You can save. I think the saving system was fairly generous, too, which is another reason I liked it. It wasn't, like, extremely punishing. Like, you die and you restart at the beginning or something.
You didn't need a typewriter ribbon or anything.
Yeah, you can make some progress on it, chip away at it, and kind of get through it.
Yeah. Someday I will play that game, but it won't be today, because today I need to tell you about the 1995 video game that has probably had the most enduring legacy of them all. And that is Mario's Picross. So, no one played this game at the time. I don't feel like the Picross series really caught on until Sudoku took off, you know, like 15 years ago. And then all of a sudden people were like, oh, wait, there's this thing that's kind of like that Nintendo makes, and they've been making these, and they're actually really good, and they're more varied and interesting than Picross or than Sudoku. Why don't we play these? And so now the developer Jupiter makes like 20 Picross games per Nintendo platform, and they just keep churning them out, and they become increasingly complex. They've got like Mega Picross and 3D Picross and stuff, and I don't know about that, but in its original incarnation, Mario's Picross for Game Boy, it is basically picture crossword. So you have a grid, and there are numeric values in each column and row. And those indicate how many blocks are colored in that row or column. And the way the numbers are clustered, you might have like 3, 1, 2. That means there is a block of 3 consecutive colored blocks, then a standalone single colored block, and then another collection of 2 contiguous colored blocks. So the challenge then is to figure out where in the row or the column do you place this? And when you're working with a 10 by 10 grid, it's usually pretty easy unless you have, you know, one row that's just like a one. And then, you know, where the hell is that going to be? So you have to kind of start from the bigger, more complex things and logic it out and say, well, okay, so we've got the 3, 1, 2. That's 6 total spaces, but also the spaces in between, that adds up to 8. If there are 10 lines on this row, that means that one of the blocks of the 3 has to be, you know, this specific block based on just the way the numbers fall. And then you start to cross compare that with the columns and adjacent rows and so forth, and slowly, steadily just sort of math your way through the grid. And it sounds maybe confusing or boring or mathematical, which it kind of is, but it's like the only way that math is actually fun on the planet. It's the one good application of math, because you're making Mario pictures. You're creating Goomba sprites with math. What a great idea. Anyway, so there was a sequel to this a couple of years later, and, you know, now I don't know how many Picross games there are on 3DS, or yes, 3DS and Switch. And lots of people make Picross clones. Konami created their own clone system where it's all like creating Konami sprites and so forth. There's Color Picross and so on and so forth. But the original Mario's Picross, still a great game. I do think it was probably at its best on 3DS because of the touchscreen element and the larger resolution. But you know what? Game Boy, still good times. The series probably shouldn't have gone on to become a sort of mainstay of the medium, but it did, and I'm happy for that.
Yeah, I'm actually kind of happy too, man. Like, this is I got a shriveled lima bean where the puzzle solving part of my brain should be, but I really really like Picross for the same reason I like Minesweeper. It's kind of like you said, you're doing good things with math, and that's very very difficult to find in life. But it's the kind of game that the Game Boy was sort of made for. And, I really love that we get to keep having that on console. I don't need newer and better Picrosses every gen, maybe, but I do want a Picross every gen so that I can play it on that hardware. That's really the main thing. I don't want to pull anything old out and play it because I'm lazy and don't want to plug it in anymore. Wonderful game.
Was it on the Game Boy?
Yeah, was it? Mario's Picross was originally on Game Boy.
Oh, because really I played the Super NES version, you know, Super Famicom version a lot on, was that in 95 as well?
I don't know. I think that came later.
It's the game I've played the most on the Nintendo Switch Super NES thing. For some reason, I played Mario's Picross like crazy. I love it.
I am a bona fide Minesweeper addict, and I love Picross for the same reasons.
Yeah, it's a great game.
Mario Super Picross, 95 in Japan.
Yeah. Wow. Technically counts, yes.
But Mario's Picross was March 85.
Or 95.
Yeah, March September. 95, yeah, September. So there you go, Game Boy, Game Boy first.
Wow.
We all know that's how it works. So Mario's Picross. Okay, so that's been most of this episode. Binge, I know you've been dying to talk about balls all episode, mm-hmm. So we're going to let you wrap this up, bring it home. Tell us about Vectorman, the game that is all about balls, okay?
Am I not allowed to say the T word?
No, you are not. Okay. Because that's not what these are.
Vectorman is another game I got at Blockbuster, believe it or not. One of these, you know, used previously rented games, and man, it blew me away. I think I got this, you know, probably 96, even though it came out in October 95 in America. And I bought a used Genesis from my friend in high school in 96, like for $20 or something. I don't remember. It's a pretty good deal. And it was a Genesis 2, and I needed software for it, so I bought like Gauntlet 4 at Toys R Us. They still had some games at that time, and I got Vector Man, and man, Vector Man is really cool because it has these, you know, Dynamite Heady style
jointed sprites is what I would call it.
Yeah, jointed sprite thing that's also in the game we talked about earlier that slipped my mind by a treasure. That's the Gunstar Heroes has some enemies like that. There are these balls that move around, giving a smooth pseudo 3D animated look to, to the graphics.
Yeah, I think people
not really 3D,
really kind of started to see that employed a lot by Konami in the 80s with games like Contra. You know, you'd have like an alien and the body would be a stationary background, but then it would have arms that would like swing around and attack you. And those would be sprites that were just kind of strung along a line so that they could rotate and move at different speeds to create the sense of like, here is an undulating tube or something.
Yeah.
So it's, Contra had that, Life Force, Gradius, some other games that escape me at the moment.
Streets of Rage 2, I think, had it for like the alien mini boss.
Oh, okay. Yeah, there you go. Yeah. So it was kind of a popular technique, and Sega basically said, we're going all in. We're going to make some tubes out of balls. And
developed by Blue Sky Software, which is cool. And it's just, I forgot to mention, it's a platform game where you run around and you jump and you shoot, you know, you're shooting. It's a shooting platformer. I don't know if you call this running guns. I don't know, but
yeah,
it's great.
Yeah, it has a really good sense of atmosphere, which is surprising because like the character is just a bunch of green spheres. Mm-hmm. But there's something kind of alien and imposing about a character like that, sort of inhuman, that actually really fits the Sega Genesis, which had this sort of cold mechanical sound and look to it, like a very specific palette. Like, to me, the iconic Genesis games are less like Sonic the Hedgehog and more ones that are like, this is, you know, a video game where you are in a hell made of robots. That just, I don't know, that just fits the tech.
It's dystopian, set in a dystopian future in the year 2049, where Earth has become a toxic wasteland. So it's like the music. This is what struck me. This is the first game I had ever heard with a techno soundtrack. I remember that really struck me when I got out, when I got it, because that was,
you're like, oh, this sounds like my Mortal Kombat movie soundtrack.
Yeah, it was like a new, you know, fashionable thing at that time, that kind of music being popular and, you know, used in things like this. Anyway, so yeah, it's a very environmental, it's got great sound effects too, great sound, great frame rate, smooth. Every game I love has a great frame rate. I hate choppy games. That's the same with Mario World 2, Yoshi's Island. Is just, you know, the Super FX 2 makes everything butter smooth. And in this case, Vector Man is really smooth, all of the transformations and motions and everything. Great.
A year after playing Vector Man, I went to see The Rock, the Sean Connery movie, in theaters. And I thought that those big glass balls that they were carrying around that were full of VX gas looked just like Vector Man the whole movie. It kind of took me out of the film. I kept getting tickled because I was like, no, don't break Vector Man. But
they should have done a Puzzle Bobble Vector Man crossover where there's like a monster or a guy made out of the balls from Puzzle Bobble. And anyway.
Yeah,
they all hatch, and then Yoshi spits them out, and everything's connected, man. I'm telling you.
I never got to spend too much time with Vector Man back at the day. I remember it was a game that I mostly saw, you know, at kiosks for the Sega Genesis. It was like one of their big. I feel like this was their flagship game for the '95 like Christmas season. That and Toy Story, but I really did appreciate it once I did get to go back and play it, because you've talked about it does play very smoothly. It doesn't really look like anything else. I think the closest analog you could make is like Donkey Kong Country, but even then it very much has its own visual style and appeal. And I don't know, I know there's a Vector Man 2, I know there's other big Genesis games that came out in 96, and I think even a few in 97, but this feels like sort of the last big hurrah for the system.
It was.
And it was a good note to start winding down on.
It was definitely, it felt like a late era game at the time. Yeah. I remember it feeling like, and it was great. So
it did feel late era. That year they were trying to sell us so many different things that it got confusing, but Vector Man was a good one to try to sell us as opposed to, you know, the 32X.
I would say that it's kind of the Genesis is equivalent to Yoshi's Island. I think that's totally fair. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Better Rystar, which also was 95.
Yeah. It's a showpiece for sure.
It's all connected, man. Or Yoshi's Island with Vector Man made out of eggs. That could have been another crossover they missed.
Ooh. You know, the sky is wide open now that Sega and Nintendo like to team up. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you know, maybe they'll probably get RZS to create it, and no one wants that.
You know, maybe if the Super NES had had blast processing, we could have gotten Vector Man made out of Yoshi eggs. What could have been?
Yeah.
What could have been indeed?
Well, we'll have to leave it at that. Just mourn the future that never was, or the past that never was. Anyway, mourn something. Just be sad. That's the message of this episode of Retronauts.
I told
Come
you.
Away feeling bummed out.
All the joy.
All
drained.
The joy. Yep. Binge, it's spreading. You brought it. It's like a virus.
I'm glad. I hope I brought all of you down this episode and made you feel
absolutely
miserable.
Mission accomplished.
We started as mummies and we finished even more dead. Look at that.
God, you hear that thunder? Man.
I do. Man, yeah, this storm outside. I'm happy we haven't had a power out, but it was wild because there was no rain, nothing, just kind of gloomy. And there was a crack of thunder that shook the house and sounded like, you know, a bomb detonating. And immediately it began pouring rain. It was like straight out of corny Hollywood. It was, I've never seen something like that before. It was like, all of us just jumped in shock at the sound of this thunder. And then all of a sudden it was just, you know, biblical deluge outside. Wild. But even the weather is sad about 1995 in video gaming, which is a shame. It shouldn't be, because there was a lot of great stuff, even if there was no Vector Man made of Yoshi eggs. So anyway, gentlemen, thank you for your time. We've only barely touched on the world of 1995, but hopefully in the past three episodes, we've kind of provided some context of what the world of video games like, what the world of video games was like 30 years ago, 40 years ago, even 50 years ago, and how different, and in many ways, not so different it is today. So thank you for your time, starting with Chris Sims, who cannot be here today. Thanks Ooh. For nothing, Chris.
We should do a 95 part two with Chris.
We're not going to do that, but I'll make sure that next year we call him in for 96, and he can really just go to town on that.
It'll be the director's cut.
So if you have enjoyed this episode and it hasn't made you too sad to want to listen to more episodes like it, well, that's great, because there are so many episodes that you can listen to of Retronauts. We are a podcast that has been running for more than a decade, multiple episodes most weeks if you count the bonus stuff, which you should because it's good. If you subscribe to Retronauts, we are Patreon-supported, subscription-powered, patreon.com/retronauts. A $3 monthly bid, donation, support, subscription, whatever you want to call it, gets you access to all of our episodes a week early with no advertisements and a higher bitrate quality than you hear on the free feed. But if you put in an extra $2, you also get episodes every other Friday, plus on weekends, Diamond Fights, mini columns, and some other stuff like Discord access, where you can take part in the Metroidvania Book Club. So it's quite a deal, the best deal in video games. I used to say that's an amazing amount of content for the cost of a Starbucks latte, but now Starbucks lattes cost $8. So that makes Retronauts even more remarkable a deal. Absolutely go to Retronaut or patreon.com/retronauts and subscribe and, you know, just have a normal coffee instead of a latte. It's good for you and good for the economy and good for us too. It lets us make more episodes like these and to pay contributors such as you guys. Where can we find you? I'll let you fight it out to see who goes first.
That was me. I got in first.
You did. You did get
ding,
in
ding,
first.
Ding, ding, ding. It's like the buzzer on Jeopardy. Bloop, bloop. So I'm Benj Edwards. You can find me online. I mostly hang out on Blue Sky these days. I am at BenjEdwards.com, which is not at all confusing, but that's my name. And, you know, that website also has my stuff on it and stuff. And I write about AI for Ars Technica right now, so don't shout at me. It's not my fault. I didn't make it happen. But it's an interesting world. So Hey, we forgot to talk about 2005. Did you?
No, Bob already did an episode on 2005.
Oh, okay.
Bob likes to do the modern century, the modern millennium. He is a millennial, yeah. So we let him do the millennial episodes.
Yeah, I'm right on the verge.
Not us Gen Xers, though.
Yeah.
Hey, I'm a millennial.
You're an exennial.
Exennial.
A zennial. Yeah, I always thought I was a Gen Xer growing up. So
you're a millennial with the old man brain of a Gen Xer.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay, Binge, that's where we can find you, making sound effects and buzzers and stuff. Mm-hmm. Kevin, what about you? Where can we find you on the internet?
Well, when I don't have Gen Xer on Wii, I can be found on Blue Sky.
I don't remember seeing Gen Xer on Wii. Was that published by Nintendo?
I think that one was a PC Engine one there.
Hmm.
But yes, on Wii? I'm on Blue Sky at atariarchive.org, which is also my website. It is also the name of my book. You can find that on Limited Run Games and Amazon, Atari Archive Volume 1. That, in turn, is a spinoff of my video series on YouTube, where I'm going through the Atari 2600 library in chronological order and delving into the history and context of every single one of these releases. And the book is a greatly expanded take on the first 2 years of the 2600's life. Very much recommend it. I might be biased, but check it out. And check out my other work.
All right, and Jared.
Yeah, hi, I'm Jared, and I'm unemployed. But when I'm not out there uselessly banging my head against yet another application, I am writing things for IGN right now, fairly regularly, and you can find a lot of my work over there at the moment. I also do the Top 100 Games podcast. That's a real thing and a lot of fun. And, finally, you know, you can find me on Blue Sky, Threads, or Instagram as Petty, Jared, and that's spelled C-O-M-M-A. So P-E-T-T-Y-C-O-M-M-A-J-A-R-E-D. And I'm just the lovely human being to follow. So, you know, and finally, I'm very excited. You guys get paid? Wait, what? What was that earlier? Like,
yeah, everyone who appears on Retronauts should invoice about it.
I didn't know that.
I thought this was a known thing.
I had no idea. I'm so excited.
And you've been doing it free this whole time.
Oh, yeah, totally. Wow.
I'm not good at keeping track of who invoices. I just assume people invoice and I'll pay it. And that's probably paying people who aren't on the show. They just send me invoices and are like, hey, Jeremy. Okay, sure.
Okay, I'll send it off. It's great. No, yeah, but all seriousness, thank you very much for having me. This is a precious place for me, and any time I get invited to be on is really special. So appreciate it. Thanks.
Well, thanks for being on. I miss working with you.
I miss working with you.
Thank you for forcing me to do this.
Absolutely. Yeah. We're going to drag you in.
Miserable.
Anyway, finally, you can find me, the jackass rodeo ringmaster of Retronauts. Was that what it was called? The Jackass Rodeo?
You called yourself that. Yeah, you called it the Jackass Rodeo once. Yeah. That's a Jeremy Parrish original.
That's an old timer. Yep. Yeah. It just popped into my head. I remember Chris Kohler saying, yeehaw. Yeah. So that's lived for eternity in the back of my brain.
Oh, wait, no, that one was different. You don't want to bring that one up. You should cut that from your notes.
All right. Sure thing. So anyway, yeah, you can find me on Blue Sky as Jay Parrish, J-P-A-R-I-S-H, Blue Sky Social. You can find me making stuff at limitedrungames.com. Currently, I'm putting together books, like a Shantae strategy guide, finishing that one up to get Matt Bozon's approval. Hooray! Also some other stuff that I can't talk about. I'm always here on Retronauts. Well, not always, but often here on Retronauts. And I'm always on my YouTube channel, which is called Jeremy Parrish. You can find me there publishing books, doing other things. And I finally started to get some of my websites back online. So you could go to SayGuiden.com and see articles about the SG-1000 because I know you love it. So there you go. Anyway, that's me. That's them. That's us. That's the show. And that was the Years in Review. We're done now. So please join us again in like 6 months to get started on the next round. Hooray. Good times. Thanks, gentlemen. And thanks, listeners. And please look forward to another Retronauts episode in a week. And I think I'm hosting that one too. So there's no escape. Let's see.
There'll be
no escape for the princess this time. Yes, we're talking about the best RPG of 1996 next week. So please join us. Until then, please don't join us. Please go do other things and try not to be too sad about Vectorman never being made of Yoshi eggs.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.